Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Alice Henderson joins me today for the second time on Conversations Live, this time with her new book, A Ghost of Caribou, the third installment in the Alex Carter suspense series. We first talked about the second book in the series, A Blizzard of Polar Bears, last year, and you can find that podcast with Alice on our website at conversationslive.net. Just type in the name of the second book, A Blizzard of Polar Bears, and it pops straight up. Alice has also written media tie-in novels, which include official novels for the TV shows Supernatural and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and while working at LucasArts, wrote material for several Star Wars video games. Now, in addition to all of that, being a prolific writer, Alice is a sanctuary monitor for the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, where she checks remote cameras, does mapping, and delivers wildlife surveys to determine what species are present and make sure there are no signs of poaching. She's surveyed for the presence of grizzlies, wolves, wolverines, jaguars, endangered bats, and the list goes on. And it's all these experiences in remote corners of wilderness and her love of science and wildlife that inspired Alice to create the Alex Carter Mystery Series. So let me bring her right on. The book is called A Ghost of Caribou, and here's my guest, Alice Henderson. Alice Henderson, welcome to the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicki. I'm honored to be here.
Yeah, so pleased to have you back because I loved your last book, A Blizzard of Polar Bears. And today we're talking about A Ghost of Caribou. So tell us a little bit about what's been going on since we last talked, since Blizzard of Polar Bears came out and now this one is out. What's been happening with you?
Well, I just had the pleasure of going on a four-month camping trip all through the Canadian Rockies and the American Rockies, and it was just fabulous. I got to see fall and Yellowstone and the Grand Tetons, so it was just gorgeous seeing these brilliantly gold aspen trees against the green pines and gray mountains.
Oh, beautiful. And that was that work-related?
Well, it was sort of work-related. I'm always looking for new settings for these books and different wildlife projects to help with, so I always have my eye out for that sort of thing. And I was up there looking at American pika populations in both the Canadian Rockies and the American Rockies.
Oh, very interesting. And when you say camping trip, I'm assuming you mean a tent since you were up in the Rockies?
Oh. I kind of alternate. I do have a tent. And then I also have a little tiny hard-sided camper because a lot of the places up there actually won't let you camp if you're not in a hard-sided structure of some kind. So just in case I'm in some place like that, I will bring my little hard-sided one, like a tiny little pop-up.
Yeah, very cool. So let's dive straight into this because there's tons to talk about. I know last time we chatted, you mentioned this book was coming up and that you had done some research on this, but each book, this is the third in the Alex Carter series, and she's a wildlife researcher and often gets sent off to investigate these wild adventures, and this one is no different. So why caribou for this particular story?
Well, I've always been fascinated with caribou, and mountain caribou are critically endangered. In fact, we just lost our last two in 2019 here in the lower 48 states. So we don't have any left. And I really wanted to address that, like what had happened with the caribou, how we lost them, what could have been done to save them, and what steps we can take moving forward that would improve habitat for them and maybe even possibly get a few back down here.
Yeah. And so I told you when we chatted before we started talking here, I always learn a lot reading your books because I love to go research, and there's plenty to research about this. And I know you did your own research on it anyway. But it wasn't until I was thinking, okay, let's learn more about, you know, caribou and where they are and all that stuff. I did not know that reindeer and caribou were the same animal. I had no idea. Maybe that sounds really silly, but I've seen reindeer in Norway. It wasn't until just that I realized they're both one and the same. So,
yes, I'm not surprised. They look different, right? Their antlers are different, and there are several reindeer and caribou subspecies around the globe. So the ones that we have here are different subspecies than the ones there.
Yeah. And so let's talk a little bit about the synopsis of the storyline. So we meet up again with Alex Carter, who's called upon to investigate a camera sighting of what could possibly be a mountain caribou in the Selkirk Mountains of Washington. So for those who love to read about local locations, this is also a great story. So take this away and just give us a synopsis of the story, if you would, Alice.
Of course. So Alex Carter is tasked with seeing if this blurry image that a land trust got on their property is of a mountain caribou, which would be monumental because, as I said earlier, mountain caribou have disappeared from the lower 48 several years ago. So it is one down there. It's pretty monumental. But when she arrives, she quickly learns that her only challenge isn't going to be finding this elusive caribou on this massive piece of land, because loggers and activists are clashing in the area over a swath of old-growth forest marked for clear-cutting. And then the murdered body of a forest ranger is found strung up in the town's park, and Alex learns of a backcountry hiker who went missing in the same area the year before. So as she ventures into the forest in search of this endangered animal, she quickly finds herself in a fight for her life. She's caught between factions warring for the future of the forest and a murderer stalking the dense groves of ancient trees.
Mm. And it takes us on quite a ride there. So we talked about why caribou. How did the idea for the story for Alex's part come together for you? What was the inspiration?
Well, I was actually working on a couple of caribou projects, and much like Alex is doing in the book, I was looking at footage from cameras that are hanging on collars of caribou, and from this you can determine they take little, like, 10-second clips of a caribou's day. So throughout the day, these little 10-second clips are recorded on these collar cameras. And you can determine all kinds of neat stuff from watching this footage, like if the caribou has a calf, we hang them on female caribous, and then how much time, say, they spend eating or traveling or resting or avoiding insects. And so working on these projects, I did two. I helped with a project for the 40-mile caribou herd, which is up in Alaska, Yukon area, and then the porcupine caribou herd, which is also in a similar area. And these are these barren ground caribou, which are different than mountain caribou, where they have massive herds of many thousands of members. And just seeing how neat this footage was and getting a little slice of these caribou lives every day, I was really inspired and enchanted to do my next book on them, and I chose mountain caribou because of their incredibly precarious situation, although barren ground caribou aren't doing so well either.
And the barren ground, as I understand it, they're the most common up in Alaska, the most common ones that we see, right?
Absolutely. You've probably seen footage, aerial footage of these massive migrating herds that are just covering the landscape. I mean, it's so neat to see. Just a barren ground.
Yeah, and since they're called barren ground, I'm, you know, assuming that they're on that barren tundra most of the
time. Yeah, tundra. Sometimes they go to higher ridges, high alpine ridges. Sometimes they are in forested areas or in what we call the tussock area with these clumps of grass. So, yeah, they have a wide range of habitat, too.
Right. And so what's the difference between them and the mountain caribou? I read the mountain caribou tend to stay in very small groups, maybe just as many as 50 in a herd. Is that true?
That's absolutely right, yes. So whereas the barren ground are in these massive thousands and thousands of members in their herd, mountain caribou have much smaller herds, like you said, about 50 or smaller, and they don't migrate those long distances like the barren ground. usually they will be in the valleys in the summer and move up to these really steep mountainous areas in the winter. And they're really unique because they can survive off lichen throughout the whole winter. And most other animals can't do this because lichen has such low nutritive value. But the caribou will go up into these high mountain areas, and they rely on very tall snowpack because the lichen they eat, which is mainly horsehair lichen and witch's hair lichen, hang from these branches of trees. So they need that tall snowpack to be able to reach up there and pull this lichen down that they survive on throughout the winter.
Right.
They have a very different niche that they're filling from the barren ground caribou.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And I want to dive into that more in a bit, but let's talk a little bit more about the book. And one of the things that, you know, Alex goes on these hairy adventures. She's got this fabulous job. I'd like her job. I think I said that last time. She works with wildlife, and she works in the great outdoors, and she loves all of that. But part of her journey is really about human connection. She doesn't have a lot of friends. She does have a friend, Zoe, she met in college, and of course her dad that she counts on. But there's a line in the book where she realizes, and I'm paraphrasing, that she was putting in 99% of the effort needed to maintain relationships along the way, and wonders if there's something wrong with her. That's something I've heard people express over the years. And she's driving to meet this person, Kathleen, hoping that their friendship develops, and yet at the same time cursing herself for even feeling the need to make deeper connections. So what does that tell us about Alex and where she's at in life?
I think Alex is one of those rare people that, as much as she leads this very isolated existence out in the wilderness, she deeply feels this need to have meaningful connection in her life. And I think she's terribly lonely. As you said, she's basically just has her best friend Zoe and her father, and she longs to make more connections like that and stronger connections. And I think she's one of those rare people that's able to make the effort to reach out and talk to other people and try to build relationships. And because of that, I think she's been burned more than once trying to develop these more meaningful friendships with people that perhaps are a little more checked out than she is, or, you know, not as willing to make the effort.
Yeah.
And I think she definitely struggles with, she loves what she does, she feels passionately about being out in the wild, but at the same time, it really has a detrimental effect on her social life.
Yeah, but that's what makes her such an interesting character as well, I think, in that she's not always pursuing a man or just looking for, you know, a love connection.
I really wanted to avoid that in the series, actually, that, and I think we talked about this last time. I didn't want her to be defined by her romantic relationship.
Yeah. So one of the things that is also, it's a very strong character in the book, is location, obviously. It's described in great detail, and you feel as though you're there. It starts, I think the first chapter starts in a town called Bellamy Falls. After we've had did you put a prologue in there? But there's a chapter in there, and then we move into Bellamy Falls, current day. Tell us about Bellamy Falls.
Well, I made the town up after spending a lot of time in the area. I wanted it to be true to the sort of feel of a neat, small, artsy town, and I wanted to make a town up just because of all of the turmoil that's going on there in the book. And setting it in a town that I wanted it to be, you know, have art galleries, a theater, but also like a real... The sheriff, I wanted it to be very contrasting, say, to the first book. If the sheriff in the first book isn't the most friendly person in the world. So I wanted Bellamy Falls to have a more friendly, inviting feel than, say, the Bitterroot town in my first book.
Yeah. And I should have put these questions the other way around, because the book actually opens in a real place, because I did Google these. I thought, I wonder if Bellamy Falls is real, and I Googled it, and Colville National Forest is real. I had not heard of it, and I think I'm finding out all these places that I have yet to explore. So tell us a little bit about Colville National Forest.
So Colville National Forest was where our last mountain caribou herd lived. It's on the Washington side of the Idaho border. So there is a big national forest swath up there, and that's the one on the Washington side. And we had a herd called the South Selkirk herd there, and it was dwindling and dwindling. It was actually put on the Endangered Species Act in 1983, but there was such a delay in a recovery plan and designating critical habitat that the numbers just continued to dwindle until there were only two left, only two caribou left. They were both females, so in 2019, Canada actually took them because they just weren't going to make it, and they took them to supplement their own dwindling herd in British Columbia. And the Colville National Forest is a really neat area because it's an inland temperate rainforest. So I think a lot of people are familiar with the rainforests on near the Washington coast, like in Olympic National Park, of the Ho rainforest. And so this is a really unique inland area that gets a lot of rain, and it's very steep mountainous terrain. It's dominated by, there's a lot of old growth. There's a red cedar and massive hemlock trees. So it's a really neat place to see.
Right, right. And so jumping back to the caribou here, part of the problem that they're having when you're talking about the snowpack and they need that deep, deep snow, and another part of the problem that they're having is the forest clearing. Why does that present such a problem to you? It's because it brings in other animals, right? And then that brings in wolves. Is that right?
That is correct. There's a few problems with the clear cutting of old growth. One is that those lichen I mentioned, those tree-growing lichen, take many, many years to grow, and they grow on these old-growth trees. So when the trees are cut, the caribou then have nothing to survive on over the winter. So that's one problem with decimating these old-growth forests. And then the wolf situation is because wolves don't normally predate on caribou, on mountain caribou. In fact, they don't have a predator-prey relationship with them at all. So, for example, if wolves are predating on deer and moose and elk, which is their normal prey, say they're feeding on moose, the moose population will go down, which then makes the wolf population go down. And then that makes the moose population rebound, which then the wolf population can rebound. But they don't have this relationship with caribou. So no matter how many caribou they predate upon, that doesn't affect the wolf population at all, but it does make the caribou population dwindle. And the problem is that when these old growth forests are clear cut, the wolves move in as other grazers that like these young forests, like moose and elk. They'll move into the young forests that are replacing the old growth, and the wolves follow them, and then suddenly now they're in the same terrain where the caribou are and predating on the caribou. And the other issue with wolves is that humans have created all these logging roads and snowmobile tracks up into this really high, steep country where the mountain caribou live. So normally the wolves in these deep snow winters wouldn't be up in this super high area, but because of these man-made roads, suddenly the wolves have access to these high areas.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing when we step back and look at how interconnected everything is and really how perfect nature is, because it makes all these accommodations in animals' coats and feet and the way they live and forage, and it puts them in the perfect landscape, biodiversity, and then along comes man and screws it all up.
And it's frustrating with the wolf situation, because instead of doing steps to save the caribou, like stopping clear-cutting old growth and limiting snowmobile use in these highly sensitive areas, they've instead, both Canada and the U.S., have just been killing the wolves as a sort of last-ditch effort. And thousands of wolves have been killed because of this.
I know. It greatly upsets me, because I just have this thing for wolves. I love wolves, and, you know, they're just trying to live and exist, right, off the land. So let's talk a little bit about how you create suspense in this, because it's definitely an art form. and you know, too much too fast can be exhausting. you know, if it's not, do you remember seeing, have you seen Private Ryan, the movie? That was so intense that first, like, I don't know, 15 minutes of the movie. I was like exhausted when it was over. But when that's in a book, it can make you want to put it down. And you have just this perfect balance, this perfect knack of creating the suspense and keeping things moving forward at a pace. So what goes into your thought process around pace and how to speed it up, how to slow it down?
That means a lot to me that you said I did it well, because that is something I particularly worry about writing these books. I think I said last year that suspense and fight scenes and action scenes and things like that are my absolute favorite thing to write.
Yeah.
But I'm very mindful of the reader needs valleys, you know, that you have these peaks of action and suspense, and then you need these restful valleys that you can descend into and sort of get to know the characters better and other downtime things before you ratchet it up again into suspense scenes. And I think another thing that's really important is that you should care about the characters. If you have a lot of suspense or action and the character is unlikable or you're not attached to them in any way, then it just doesn't have the same emotional response. You're not really worried anything's going to happen to them, or you don't care if something happens to them. So I really try to make Alex a compassionate character that readers can identify with before I put her through all of these horrible, you know, suspense and action scenes where her life is being threatened.
Yeah. And since action scenes, I know, and fight scenes in particular are your favorite scenes to write, what was, and I know you don't like the mundane, but in this particular book, what was the highlight of writing this, and what was the most challenging part for you?
The most challenging part for me to write is, as you say, the mundane parts. Because I do love action and the adrenaline of these action scenes. I'm always worried, you know, the downtime parts aren't going to be interesting enough. So I really, you know, try to make those parts interesting to match the suspense and action parts.
Yeah. And so when you are breaking up your time as a writer, a wildlife researcher, etc., what does that look like between researching, between writing, and then, of course, you've got this all-important marketing to do once the book is out? How do you manage that? Do you chunk down your time into, you know, marketing time and production time or writing time? How does that work for you?
It can be overwhelming at times. This time of year, especially because, you know, my next book is coming out in a week, but I'm also on deadline for the following book in this series. So it can get pretty busy trying to do marketing for the book that's about to come out whilst writing the current book. And then with the wildlife work, I find that it's such a different process. It's so analytical, the wildlife work, that it's just a nice break. You know, I can create for a few hours and write, and then I switch to analytical work like mapping or going through these caribou videos. And it's a really nice balance. I like it.
Yeah.
I don't tend to feel overwhelmed when I'm doing both in the same day. It's those days where I'm just doing marketing and social media and writing that can feel a little intense.
Right. But you do it well. I watched a couple of interviews with you, I remember last time, because I like to, you know, hear what an author has to say before I meet them. And I remember thinking last time you're very articulate and your passion for your work comes across. So that natural passion, I think, works well, right, on many levels.
Thank you so much. I do feel so passionately about wildlife conservation, and this series has just been wonderful because not only do I love writing and I love the action, but it's allowed me to talk about the plight of these species with so many different people, and I really love shedding light on this and what people can do to help.
Yeah. And I just want to let listeners know, this will be out on 11/16, I believe, and your book comes out 11/15, so it will already be out by the time we go live with this. And it's A Ghost of Caribou, so I just want to make sure they know that. So I want to just go back to what's some of the research and what surprised you the most, because you've been doing this a fair while now. What surprised you the most when you were researching for this?
I think what surprised me the most was the process of getting a species listed and protected on the Endangered Species Act. I think that, you know, once a species is listed, I think a lot of people think, okay, well, it's protected, yay. And it's not that at all. Just because its name has been added to the list, there's all of these steps that have to come afterward. As I mentioned earlier, they have to come up with a recovery plan, and this is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that does this. And then they have to designate critical habitat. So even though the mountain caribou was put on the Endangered Species Act in 1983, the wildlife, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, didn't designate any critical habitat. And they got sued repeatedly by different conservation organizations. And they finally, at one point, relented and stopped allowing snowmobile traffic in highly sensitive areas. But they still had not designated any critical habitat. And after being sued again, it wasn't until 2011 they started looking at this, so more than two decades later, and at first thought, oh, we'll do 300,000 acres of critical habitat. But in the end, they only designated 30,000, so a really small portion. And they were under enormous pressure from snowmobile associations and other special interest groups to take the caribou off altogether, even though there was only a handful left. They were being pressured to delist. And then after the last two were taken into Canada in 2019, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said, well, I guess we'll leave it on the Endangered Species Act, even though we didn't have any anymore. So it was really, you know, jarring for me to realize that here was this animal that was already very precarious, got protection, and it simply wasn't enough.
Yeah, and as you, I always read like the afterword and any notes that the author puts in the book, and you say in the afterword that there was a herd of mountain caribou totally wiped out in Banff National Park in 2009 simply because of an avalanche. So there's all that to take into consideration too.
Right, they have such tiny herds that if they're allowed to dwindle that much, then like a simple one act like an avalanche can just destroy the whole herd.
Yeah, and I don't think most people realize how long it takes to get this stuff approved and moving through the system. And I don't understand why it takes that long, but that's typical government for you, really, isn't it?
It's very frustrating.
Yeah. So I like that you always, you know, in your book, put a call for action, not in the story per se, but at the back. You provide a list of resources for people who might be interested in volunteering some of their time on some of the projects. And let's talk a little bit about that. And your call to action is to, you know, really reframe what we think and say about climate change. We do need to reframe it. We need to rebrand it for sure. So talk to us a little bit about that from your perspective, if you would.
Well, I think that we need to look at this climate crisis as an opportunity instead of a doomsday message. I think the doomsday message that we've been getting now for many years has made people check out. They feel overwhelmed and hopeless about it. And really addressing it is a great opportunity to build healthier lives, cleaner water, cleaner air, healthier bodies. And if we act on this climate change, I mean, so many of us now can no longer have the luxury of viewing climate change as this thing happening far away in the Arctic. We're having these disastrous wildfires and droughts and, you know, hurricanes, mega storms, and sea level rise. So now it's really in our faces, climate change. And instead of being bogged down by despair, I think we really need to start looking at it as, if we act now and there's still time, we can really build a better life. And for all of us, it's a really a great opportunity, something to look forward to if we address it, instead of this horrible, I have to make all these sacrifices to combat climate change. Think of it as an opportunity.
Yeah, and as you write in the book, you know, the difference, there are so many steps between doing absolutely nothing because we feel hopeless about it and, you know, some of the many, many steps we can take, like simple steps, like writing a simple email to our representatives.
Absolutely. You can either get out there in the streets and march and be very vocal if you want to be super active, or go into the field and help with different caribou projects. Or if that's not your thing and you just want to do, you know, smaller and smaller steps, then that's very good too. You know, for example, just eating less meat is a huge one, and writing your representatives, and then there's all kinds of interesting community science projects that you can contribute to even from your home computer.
Yeah. So we've talked a fair bit about science and what we can do to try and help improve things, but the bottom line is A Ghost of Caribou is a novel. It's a suspense novel, extremely well told. And so what do you hope people take away from this? Because there's an art, again, to including the science in and still keeping that storytelling going.
I hope that people will fall in love with these animals like I have and be inspired to take action, be that going out in the field and doing something, or like we said, just writing letters. And the Endangered Species Act has been really weakened in recent years, and if we could have things passed, like, for example, there's the Paw and Fin Act right now in Congress that hasn't been brought to a vote, but if we could, you know, encourage our representatives to bring that to a vote and strengthen the Endangered Species Act. I think there's a lot to be learned with what happened with the mountain caribou, and I don't think that it's too late for them. If we could improve habitat and bring them back down, and have the continuous mountain caribou population that crosses the Canadian and Washington border, I mean, that would be fabulous. So I think the lesson to take away from this, or what I hope readers will take away, is, you know, let's not let this continue to happen to other species. There's things we can do to save them.
Yes, yes. Well, Alice Henderson, it's always such a pleasure. The book is A Ghost of Caribou, and I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at alicehenderson.com. What's next on the agenda for you?
Well, I'm almost finished writing the fourth book in the series. It's called A Prowl of Jaguars.
Oh.
It's set in New Mexico, and Alex is tasked with finding out if very critically endangered jaguars are using a preserve in New Mexico. And, of course, the danger awaits there. She becomes under threat by a militia group, and I'm really excited to be writing it. I'm really enjoying this one.
Well, I look forward to talking with you about that when it comes out. Again, the book we talked about today, A Ghost of Caribou, and it's not too late, as you say, for us to take action. Every small little step that we take to even raise awareness with our children and our nieces and our nephews makes all the difference. So, Alice Henderson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Vicki. This has been wonderful.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.